This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, November 2000 examination, in English as a second language. Paper 4, Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you're doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. Now you're all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Kerry has seen an advertisement for an office job and is telephoning the company. In what department does she hope to work? And when exactly are the interviews being held?
Hello, is that Smith and Company? I'm telephoning about the job you advertised for a secretary in the sales department.
Ah, yes. We're holding interviews on Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. If you can wait a moment, I'll get my appointment book and take your details.
Thank you. Hello, is that Smith and Company? I'm telephoning about the job you advertised for a secretary in the sales department.
Ah, yes. We're holding interviews on Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. If you can wait a moment, I'll get my appointment book and take your details.
Thank you.
Question 2. Jim and Mary are talking about television. Why does Jim think it's a good idea for them to buy a second TV?
Jim, we're always arguing about what programs to watch on television. You always want to watch football, and I don't.
Okay, let's buy another TV. Then you can watch your favorite wildlife programs.
Jim, we're always arguing about what programs to watch on television. You always want to watch football, and I don't.
Okay, let's buy another TV. Then you can watch your favorite wildlife programs.
Question 3. Tandy is hoping to buy a theater ticket at half the normal price for next Monday's performance. Why is it not possible to do so immediately?
Good morning, Capital Theatre. How may I help you?
I want to buy a half-price ticket for next Monday's performance.
I'm afraid that the half-price tickets are only sold on the day of the performance. We open at 10 each morning. Morning, Capital Theatre. How may I help you?
I want to buy a half-price ticket for next Monday's performance.
I'm afraid that the half-price tickets are only sold on the day of the performance. We open at 10 each morning.
Question 4. You have arranged to drive to the seaside on Saturday. Why might it take you a long time to get there?
Because of the forecast of excellent weather this weekend, very heavy traffic is expected, especially on main roads to the coast.
Question 5. You have gone into town to buy some sports shoes, but they are not available. How long will you have to wait before receiving them from this shop? And how might you be able to find some earlier than this?
I'm afraid that we're out of stock of those shoes. I suggest that you place an order and we can get them for you in 2 to 3 weeks' time. Or if that's not soon enough, we have another branch in Broad Street which sells them.
Question 6. Rachel and Richard have gone to a restaurant to have a celebration dinner. Why is the restaurant closed?
Oh, dear. The Tasty Pie is closed. There's a notice on the door saying that because of problems with the refrigerators, it's shut until further notice.
What a shame. Well, how about trying out that new Jamaican restaurant instead? It should be open.
Oh, dear. The Tasty Pie is closed. There's a notice on the door saying that because of problems with the refrigerators, it's shut until further notice.
What a shame. Well, how about trying out that new Jamaican restaurant instead? It should be open.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part two, exercise one. Question seven. Listen to the following interview with Shanta Carlson, a marine biologist at the London Aquarium. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
And welcome to Wildlife World, our weekly survey of news and views about the animal kingdom. Each week we begin the show with an item about careers working with animals. And today, we're delighted to have someone who works at the London Aquarium with us in the studio. Shanta Carlson, it's good to meet you, and welcome to Wildlife World.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell me, did you always want to be a marine biologist?
No, but I've always loved the sea, living by it all my life.
Did you go to college?
I studied at Southampton University, where I did a degree in oceanography with biology. After that, I did a one-year course in marine resource development and protection. I really wanted to get into protecting the sea, and the course was about environmental management of the sea.
What about your working day?
Well, I start at about 9 a.m. There's a lot of maintenance to be done, like checking the systems, the water filtration, and feeding the 350 different species of fish we house. There are 10 of us doing this job at the aquarium, and we're all on a rota. Sometimes I talk to people by the rock pool, or go diving in the big tanks with the tropical and Pacific sharks, which I love doing. I generally finish at 6 p.m. But these are live animals, and their needs come before yours. If there's more work to do, you have to stay late. I always get 2 days off a week, but I have to work 2 weekends and 3.
What do you like about your job?
Being in the tanks with the sharks. The biggest shark is as big as me, but it's not dangerous, because these animals are used to eating fish, not humans. I can see the visitors watching me, and it's exciting to see the looks on their faces as the sharks cruise past you.
And is there anything you don't like?
The worst part of my job is early on Monday, getting into the cold tanks in a diving suit. I have to clean the tanks when the water is almost freezing.
What about your future, say in 10 years' time?
There are several routes I could take. I could end up being a fish curator, who decides where fish go and what type of fish we have in a museum or aquarium. On the other hand, I'm really interested in teaching, so I might get more into the educational side of marine biology.
How much holiday do you have?
I get 20 days per year, which isn't bad, considering it's not as if I take my work home with me in the evenings. I don't even have a fish tank at home.
What about earnings?
I don't earn much. But the greatest thing about this job is not the earnings, but the fact it's such an international thing. There are lots of possibilities of travel.
It sounds as if you have a fascinating job. Chanta Carlson, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
Now you will hear the interview again.
And welcome to Wildlife World, our weekly survey of news and views about the animal kingdom. Each week we begin the show with an item about careers working with animals. And today we're delighted to have someone who works at the London Aquarium with us in the studio. Chanta Carlson, it's good to meet you, and welcome to Wildlife World.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell me, did you always want to be a marine biologist?
No, but I've always loved the sea, living by it all my life.
Did you go to college?
I studied at Southampton University, where I did a degree in oceanography with biology. After that, I did a 1-year course in marine resource development and protection. I really wanted to get into protecting the sea, and the course was about environmental management of the sea.
What about your working day?
Well, I start at about 9 a.m. There's a lot of maintenance to be done, like checking the systems, the water filtration, and feeding the 350 different species of fish we house. There are 10 of us doing this job at the aquarium, and we're all on a rota. Sometimes I talk to people by the rock pool, or go diving in the big tanks with the tropical and Pacific sharks, which I love doing. I generally finish at 6 p.m., but these are live animals, and their needs come before yours. If there's more work to do, you have to stay late. I always get 2 days off a week, but I have to work 2 weekends and 3.
What do you like about your job?
Being in the tanks with the sharks. The biggest shark is as big as me, but it's not dangerous, because these animals are used to eating fish, not humans. I can see the visitors watching me, and it's exciting to see the looks on their faces as the sharks cruise past you.
And is there anything you don't like?
The worst part of my job is early on a Monday, getting into the cold tanks in a diving suit. I have to clean the tanks when the water is almost freezing.
What about your future, say in 10 years' time?
There are several routes I could take. I could end up being a fish curator, who decides where fish go and what type of fish we have in a museum or aquarium. On the other hand, I'm really interested in teaching, so I might get more into the educational side of marine biology.
How much holiday do you have?
I get 20 days per year, which isn't bad, considering it's not as if I take my work home with me in the evenings. I don't even have a fish tank at home.
What about earnings?
I don't earn much. But the greatest thing about this job is not the earnings, but the fact it's such an international thing. There are lots of possibilities of travel.
It sounds as if you have a fascinating job. Shanta Carlson, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
That is the end of exercise one. In a moment, you will hear exercise two. Now look at the questions for exercise two. Part 2. Exercise 2. Question 8. A school group is taking part in an activity holiday. The group leader is telling the students what they will be doing that week. Listen to what he says, and then complete the diary page. You will hear his speech twice.
Welcome to the activity week, everyone. The idea of the holiday is to let everyone try a new sport and sample a range of activities under the guidance of friendly, qualified instructors. The emphasis for the week will always be on fun and enjoyment. Our first activity will begin on Monday morning at 9:30, when we'll be going horse riding along a pleasant river path and into open countryside. Meet at the reception desk. All the specialist gear you need will be provided, so you don't need to bring anything. Could those with some previous experience of horse riding put their hands up? Thank you. On Monday evening at 8 p.m, there will be a welcome party in the dining room, where you can meet up and get to know each other over coffee and biscuits. Tuesday morning is devoted to water sports of one kind or another, including windsurfing, canoeing, and sailing in small dinghies. Check your particular group by looking at the list on the notice board. On Tuesday afternoon, there's an opportunity to learn climbing. The first hour will be devoted to a lecture by Mr. Danda on climbing practice and safety. Then, you'll be doing some gentle rock climbing yourselves. The spectacular views you'll get are certainly worth the climb. On Wednesday, we'll start the day with a session on map reading skills. In the afternoon, we'll be going on a long walk across the hills to test those newly acquired map reading skills. Oh, the scenery is really dramatic, so it's well worth bringing a camera if you've got one. You can stop and take photographs whenever you like. On Thursday, in the morning, there's a choice of end-of-holiday trips, such as a visit to a wildlife park, historic house, or bird watching at a nature reserve. I'll be checking your preference later in the week, so don't worry, you don't have to decide now. We'll be returning early because there's a football match arranged for the afternoon. There will then be a farewell party and barbecue. Oh, now don't forget to put your suitcases by the front door immediately after the football match, as we'll be leaving for home straight after the barbecue. Well, hope you've managed to get all that down. Are there any questions? No? Well, then thank you for listening. I hope you have a great holiday. Thank you.
Now you will hear the group leader's speech again.
Welcome to the activity week, everyone. The idea of the holiday is to let everyone try a new sport and sample a range of activities under the guidance of friendly, qualified instructors. The emphasis for the week will always be on fun and enjoyment. Our first activity will begin on Monday morning at 9:30, when we'll be going horse riding along a pleasant river path and into open countryside. Meet at the reception desk. All the specialist gear you need will be provided, so you don't need to bring anything. Could those with some previous experience of horse riding put their hands up? Ah, thank you. On Monday evening at 8 p.m, there will be a welcome party in the dining room, where you can meet up and get to know each other over coffee and biscuits. Tuesday morning is devoted to water sports of one kind or another, including windsurfing, canoeing, and sailing in small dinghies. Check your particular group by looking at the list on the notice board. On Tuesday afternoon, there's an opportunity to learn climbing. The first hour will be devoted to a lecture by Mr. Danda on climbing practice and safety. Then, you'll be doing some gentle rock climbing yourselves. The spectacular views you'll get are certainly worth the climb. On Wednesday, we'll start the day with a session on map reading skills. In the afternoon, we'll be going on a long walk across the hills to test those newly acquired map reading skills. Oh, the scenery is really dramatic, so it's well worth bringing a camera if you've got one. You can stop and take photographs whenever you like. On Thursday, in the morning, there's a choice of end-of-holiday trips, such as a visit to a wildlife park, historic house, or bird watching at a nature reserve. I'll be checking your preference later in the week, so don't worry, you don't have to decide now. We'll be returning early because there's a football match arranged for the afternoon. There will then be a farewell party and barbecue. Oh, now don't forget to put your suitcases by the front door immediately after the football match, as we'll be leaving for home straight after the barbecue. Well, hope you've managed to get all that down. Are there any questions? No? Well, then thank you for listening. I hope you have a great holiday.
That is the end of part two. There will be a short break before you hear part three.
In a moment you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Exercise 1. Question 9. Listen to the following radio interview with a postman in the countryside. Then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Today we're going to hear about the life of a countryside postman. Norman Dunbar, welcome to the studio. Tell me, are countryside communities on your postal round changing?
Not really, no. There are no real communities, just remote farmhouses where the same families have been for generations. They are miles from anywhere, and there are no shops or near neighbours. I've got to know just about everyone. and I speak to them most days.
Mm. Do you feel that you've become part of their lives?
Well, after a few years, yes, I begin to. You know when they're ill, when they're well, when old ones have died, and when babies are due.
Would you be happy for someone to swap post routes with you?
Put it this way, I'd fight to keep my route. But every few years, a more senior person arrives, and he or she has the choice of the best job. So far, they haven't wanted to take my job. It wouldn't suit everyone.
You sound as though you look forward to going to work.
Oh, yes, I do enjoy seeing these people. I've a little school on my postal round. I think it must be the smallest in the region, with just 12 children in it. They all know me. In such isolated places, people always have time to talk. You can find you're running late if you've been having a chat, but it doesn't matter to me.
Can you briefly describe your day's routine?
The sorting office is only a short distance from my house. I start sorting mail at 0500 hours, and I'll be doing this for an hour. You get the mail for your own round and sort it before starting off. The van is parked outside the office. I finish delivering the mail at 1100 hours and then set off for home. I'm back in the town by lunchtime.
And do you deliver the mail when it snows heavily?
I get as far as I can. I often follow the snow plough, but I've once been stuck in thick snow until late afternoon, before a farmer pulled me out. I always carry waterproofs, a thick coat, and a spade just in case. You don't need a lot of snow to stop the van on steep bits. If it looks as if it's an important letter, I'll walk there.
Do postmen in the countryside get remembered well at Christmas time?
Oh, very. I'm given everything from money to chocolates, puddings and turkeys. Most people give me something. They don't so much in towns because they don't really know their postman as they do out in the countryside.
Imagine you won a large amount of money in a competition. Would it change your life?
I've sometimes wondered what I'd do in a situation like that. But I love this job, and I can't see myself giving it up.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today we're going to hear about the life of a countryside postman. Norman Dunbar, welcome to the studio. Tell me, are countryside communities on your postal round changing?
Not really, no. There are no real communities, just remote farmhouses where the same families have been for generations. They are miles from anywhere and there are no shops or near neighbours. I've got to know just about everyone, and I speak to them most days.
Mm. Do you feel that you've become part of their lives?
Well, after a few years, yes, I begin to. You know when they're ill, when they're well, when old ones have died, and when babies are due.
Would you be happy for someone to swap post routes with you?
Put it this way, I'd fight to keep my route. But every few years a more senior person arrives and he or she has the choice of the best job. So far they haven't wanted to take my job. It wouldn't suit everyone.
You sound as though you look forward to going to work.
Oh, yes, I do enjoy seeing these people. I've a little school on my postal round. I think it must be the smallest in the region, with just 12 children in it. They all know me. In such isolated places, people always have time to talk. You can find you're running late if you've been having a chat, but it doesn't matter to me.
Can you briefly describe your day's routine?
The sorting office is only a short distance from my house. I start sorting mail at 0500 hours, and I'll be doing this for an hour. You get the mail for your own round and sort it before starting off. The van is parked outside the office. I finish delivering the mail at 1100 hours and then set off for home. I'm back in the town by lunchtime.
And do you deliver the mail when it snows heavily?
I get as far as I can. I often follow the snow plow, but I've once been stuck in thick snow until late afternoon, before a farmer pulled me out. I always carry waterproofs, a thick coat, and a spade just in case. You don't need a lot of snow to stop the van on steep bits. If it looks as if it's an important letter, I'll walk there.
Do postmen in the countryside get remembered well at Christmas time?
Oh, very. I'm given everything from money to chocolates, puddings and turkeys. Most people give me something. They don't so much in towns because they don't really know their postman as they do out in the countryside.
Imagine you won a large amount of money in a competition. Would it change your life?
I've sometimes wondered what I'd do in a situation like that. But I love this job, and I can't see myself giving it up.
That is the end of Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2.
Part 3. Exercise 2. Question 10. Listen to the interview about electricity on board aeroplanes. Then answer the following questions. You will hear the interview twice.
Electricity has become such an accepted part of modern life that we would be lost without it. Countless conveniences which we take for granted, such as cookers, refrigerators, TVs and lighting could not operate without a source of electric power. The situation aboard a modern aircraft is no different. Peter Pletcher from Frankfurt Airport is here to tell us about electricity in aeroplanes. Peter, hello.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me onto your program.
How is an aircraft provided with electrical power, Peter?
Well, of course, it has to generate its own. The generators are connected to the jet engines and work in the same way as a car generator or a bicycle dynamo.
I see. Do the generators produce much power?
Oh, yes. On a Boeing 747, 325 kilowatts of electricity is produced. Did you know that if all the electrical devices installed in an aircraft were switched on at once, then 224 kilowatts of electric power would be required? That's the amount consumed by 15 private homes.
That is a lot. So how does the aircraft use the electricity?
Well, most is consumed in the kitchens, or galleys as they're called.
Mm-hmm.
Then, a further 20% is used by electronic, hydraulic and technical systems on board. 13% is used for the air conditioning, 5% for lighting, 3% for the in-flight entertainment system.
Oh.
The remainder is consumed by the de-icing system for the cockpit windows and the water pipes in the galleys and toilets.
What about the reliability of the supply?
Of course, the power supply on an aircraft must not fail. Obviously, it has to satisfy stringent testing standards. Well, think about the onboard flight computers. Only minimal fluctuations in their supply voltage can be allowed.
But surely the jet engines don't always run at the same speed.
Exactly. There's a device between the engine and generator to ensure that the electricity is supplied at a uniform rate. There's also a backup emergency generator delivering 5 kilowatts of power, which is enough to operate vital systems, such as the onboard computer and cockpit equipment.
I see. But where does the aircraft get its electricity from when it's parked in the airport with its engines turned off?
This comes from an auxiliary power unit, the APU. Some airports provide an external power unit, the EPU. But increasingly, power is supplied at all parking positions, so that aircraft can plug directly into a power source.
Peter Pleasure, that was fascinating. Now we know. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Electricity has become such an accepted part of modern life that we would be lost without it. Countless conveniences which we take for granted, such as cookers, refrigerators, TVs and lighting, could not operate without a source of electric power. The situation aboard a modern aircraft is no different. Peter Pleasure from Frankfurt Airport is here to tell us about electricity in aeroplanes. Peter, hello.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me onto your program.
How is an aircraft provided with electrical power, Peter?
Well, of course, it has to generate its own. The generators are connected to the jet engines and work in the same way as a car generator or a bicycle dynamo.
I see. Do the generators produce much power?
Oh, yes. On a Boeing 747, 325 kilowatts of electricity is produced. Did you know that if all the electrical devices installed in an aircraft were switched on at once, then 224 kilowatts of electric power would be required? That's the amount consumed by 15 private homes.
That is a lot. So how does the aircraft use the electricity?
Well, most is consumed in the kitchens, or galleys, as they're called.
Mm-hmm.
Then, a further 20% is used by electronic, hydraulic and technical systems on board. 13% is used for the air conditioning, 5% for lighting, 3% for the in-flight entertainment system.
Oh.
The remainder is consumed by the de-icing system for the cockpit windows and the water pipes in the galleys and toilets.
What about the reliability of the supply?
Of course, the power supply on an aircraft must not fail. Obviously, it has to satisfy stringent testing standards. Well, think about the onboard flight computers. Only minimal fluctuations in their supply voltage can be allowed.
But surely the jet engines don't always run at the same speed.
Exactly. There's a device between the engine and generator to ensure that the electricity is supplied at a uniform rate. There's also a backup emergency generator delivering 5 kilowatts of power, which is enough to operate vital systems, such as the onboard computer and cockpit equipment.
I see. But where does the aircraft get its electricity from when it's parked in the airport with its engines turned off?
This comes from an auxiliary power unit, the APU. Some airports provide an external power unit, the EPU. But increasingly, power is supplied at all parking positions, so that aircraft can plug directly into a power source.
Peter Pleasure, that was fascinating. Now we know. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is the end of part 3, and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, candidate number, and center number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.